If you found your spot there, Matthew chapter 15, we'll get to the passage here in a second. But I'm sure that many of you are old enough to remember the TV sitcom The Odd Couple. For some of you younger folks, maybe not so much, but those of you that are a little bit older, you might recall this funny situation where two men who were both divorcees are now sharing an apartment together, and these two guys could not have been more opposite. One was Oscar Madison. Now, Oscar was a beer-drinking, poker-playing, cigar-smoking slob of a guy. And he liked it that way. That's exactly how he wanted his life to be. And then Felix, his roommate, was the opposite extreme. Felix was the guy who was like a compulsive, neurotic, neat freak. He was the definition of OCD, you know, back in the day that this show was on television. Because for him, everything had to be orderly. Everything had to be in its place. He always dressed very sharply. He always put everything away where it belonged. And so the whole show was about these two guys clashing on a continual basis because of the opposite extremes of who their character was. And I would imagine that many of us can maybe identify a little bit more with Oscar than maybe with Felix. Maybe we do have a few OCD people in here. That's fine. I find myself to be more Oscar-like, not so much in the cigar smoking and the poker playing and the drinking, but in just my wife complains about, you know, when I take my socks off, they are going to remain exactly where I took them off. Until, you know, either she picks them up or 5 or 6 days later, I choose to put them where they belong. And I found that anytime that I have an interaction with somebody who is, you know, more neat and orderly, I kind of want to mess with them a little bit. You know, you go into their house and in their bathroom, you notice that in the medicine cabinet, all of the labels for, you know, their medicines and so forth are all pointing directly out. And I want to move it around. I want to twist things. I want to make it kind of a mess for them a little bit. Maybe you feel the same way. But I found this, is that though I find myself to be a little bit sloppy in life, when it comes to my understanding of God, I want God to be very orderly. I want God to be very structured. I want God to be very predictable for me. I want to know what to expect God to do. Because my life is a bit of a mess. I want at least the God that I follow to be predictable so that I know what to expect. This is how God is. This is how God works. And a lot of us are probably that way, where we will create a box that we want God to fit in. And in this box, this is where God works. And God doesn't go outside of the parameters of what we have understood him to be, but he fits in that box. But there are times in life that God purposely, I believe, messes up our box. He expands himself beyond the limitations that we have placed on him. And that toys with our understanding of who God actually is. Now, something I think is very important for me to explain is this, is that God never ventures beyond his nature. God is who he is, and he works in line with what his nature is. But that does not mean that he always works in the way that we think he ought to work. There are times that we expect God to do something and we don't see him working in the way that we expect. There are times that we would not expect God to do a certain thing, and that's the very thing that God begins to do. And I'm sharing this with you because the story that we're looking at tonight is one of those stories, I think, that sometimes messes with our box that we have placed God in. That God doesn't necessarily fit into the parameters that we sometimes place on him. And it's a story that's going to begin in verse 21 of Matthew chapter 15. We're going to go ahead and read the story, and then we're going to break it down a little bit to see exactly what Jesus is doing here. So follow along with me, beginning with verse 21. It says, "Then Jesus went out from there and departed to the region of Tyre and Sidon. And behold, a woman of Canaan came from that region and cried out to him, saying, 'Have mercy on me, O Lord, son of David. My daughter is severely demon-possessed.' But he answered her not a word. And his disciples came and urged him, saying, 'Send her away, for she cries out after us.' But he answered and said, 'I was not sent except to the lost sheep of the house of Israel.' And then she came and worshiped him, saying, 'Lord, help me.' But he answered and said, 'It is not good to take the children's bread and throw it to the little dogs.' And she said, 'Yes, Lord, yet even the little dogs eat the crumbs which fall from their master's table.' Then Jesus answered and said to her, 'O woman, great is your faith. Let it be to you as you desire.' And her daughter was healed from that very hour." Jesus had ventured to the area of Tyre and Sidon, it tells us there in verse 21. I want you to know that these were two towns that were outside of the parameters of Israel. He had gone into Gentile territory. Now, he had been doing ministry in the area of Galilee. Tyre was about 25 miles from the Galilee region, and then Sidon was about 25 miles north of Tyre. So Jesus had really ventured fairly far away from the main hub of where his ministry was normally taking place. And it was probably because he wanted an opportunity to get a little bit of rest in along with his disciples. They had been very busy in the ministry. A lot of things had been happening. A lot of people were following after him. The religious leaders, were opposing him and so forth. And so maybe for just a little respite, they were going to get away. In fact, in Mark's telling of the same story, he says that Jesus entered a house and wanted no one to know it, which probably is indicating that that's exactly the reason that they were going there, is to just get away from it all for a few days. But Jesus really could not go very far in any direction without people finding out where he was and seeking him out. And that's exactly what's taking place here in this story. As a woman hears that Jesus is in the neighborhood, and so she hunts him down, she finds where he is, because she has a desperate, desperate need. And I think it's really important that we get to know who this woman is a little bit. We're not even given her name. We're just told that she is a woman, but we know a little bit about her heritage, because Matthew here explains that she was a woman of Canaan. Now, the Canaanites were the inhabitants of the land of Palestine, the land that Israel was given by the Lord. So the Canaanites were those inhabitants before the Israelites showed up and took over the land. And that tells us something, that this woman knows that in her heritage, her people were those that had witnessed the power of God. As the people of God began to move into the promised land and to begin to take it over, as Joshua was leading the nation at that particular time, God's power showed up. And I'm sure that stories had been passed down through the generations up until this woman of how her ancestors witnessed the power of God working through the Jewish people. On top of that, Mark tells us that she was a Greek and a Syro-Phoenician. What that meant is that she was half Syrian and half Phoenician. That also means that she was a Greek-speaking woman and was very well acquainted with the Greek culture. So we can kind of summarize it by saying that she was a Greek-speaking pagan Gentile woman from Tyre. So what does that really all mean? Well, first of all, it tells us that she was a woman that many of the Jews just would reject outright. In fact, in particular, the religious leaders within Judaism at that time would have nothing to say to this woman. They would want nothing to do with her. In fact, at that time, the first century Judaism, there was a sect of Pharisees called the Bruised and Bleeding Pharisees. And they gained that name because they had a reputation that when they were walking down the street, if they were to see a woman like this, they wouldn't even want to look upon her, so they would hide their eyes, and it was said that they would end up bumping into things because they were trying to shield themselves from even looking on a woman such as this. So they got the reputation of being called the bruised and bleeding Pharisees. So she obviously was a woman who knew that there was some hostility coming her way from the Jewish culture. But her religion tells another story. The Syrophoenicians worshipped the goddess Ashtardi. Ashtardi was the moon goddess. On top of that, those that would worship her also had a great respect and admiration for beauty. That was what their focus was. But by the first century, a lot of those Syrophoenicians who worshipped in such a way had really become disillusioned with their religion and with their form of worship. It had let them down too many times. They had been dedicated, they had been fervent, but had not felt like their goddess had met their needs, had supplied what they desired. And at that time, many of those Syrophoenicians had turned their attention towards Greek philosophy, and that became what was important to them. Now, at the time, Greek philosophy really was focusing on three things that they considered of supreme importance. The first one is freedom from all restriction. The second, expression of all human desire. And the third was the experiences that you would have by living according to those two things. Freedom from all restriction, expression of all human desire. Really, what that is a description of is do whatever you want. Live however you feel. Do whatever pleases you, because that's really what life is all about. It's interesting. We are living, I think, in a culture that has adopted that kind of philosophy as well. Many in our generation are all about self-gratification. Whatever it is that pleases me, that is what I want to pursue in life. In fact, you know, you only live once, and life is short, so you might as well pursue any type of passion or pleasure that you can find in this world, because someday it's all going to come to an end. And so many in our culture are pursuing those very things. The ironic thing about that is, though they're pursuing everything that they want, it seems that many people are more empty than they've ever been. Doing exactly what they want hasn't filled their hearts. Instead, it's left them destitute and it's left them empty. On top of that, it is even demonic. Way back nearly 100 years ago now, there was a man by the name of Aleister Crowley. He was a very well-known Satanist in his day. And he had written a book that he titled The Book of the Law. And the theme of the book could be summed up in one statement that he had made. Do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law. You know, really that is the philosophy behind Satanism. Satanism is not so much focused on worshiping the devil. What Satanism focuses on is doing whatever you want to do, living that type of a lifestyle. Now, what I'm trying to do is paint a picture for you of what culture this woman had been a part of. She had been a part of a culture who, way back when, had witnessed the power of God among the Jews. So she had some knowledge that the God of the Jews is the true and the living God. On top of that, she had been completely disillusioned with her own religion because it had really not satisfied. So many in her culture had turned to Greek philosophy to try and find satisfaction. And they found a lot of pleasure, but nothing that really filled the void that was within. And on top of that, really, they were following a satanic principle, and it might be the reason why her daughter was now demon-possessed. We don't know for sure because we're not told exactly how her daughter became demon-possessed, but you can kind of, looking at her background and where she had come from, how these things might have come to be. All that to say is this, is that right now she is in a place of absolute desperation because the daughter who she loves so much is now possessed by a demon who is tormenting her. And everything that she had experienced in her culture and in her life had not brought her any satisfaction or life or any hope for a better future. But then she hears that Jesus is in town and maybe he could offer her a little bit of hope. You know, I don't know if many of you have ever been in that place of just sitting in the midst of your own misery, maybe before you were a Christian. And you had attempted to find life in everything that this world had to offer. And you searched and you searched and you tried this and you tried that. And it might satisfy for a few days, a few weeks, a few months, but ultimately it just left you completely empty. And at some point in your life, you just realize that everything that you thought life was about has let you down. Many years ago, I had an auto insurance policy with a particular company, which I will not name. And month after month, I would pay my premiums, knowing that when I needed them the most, they would be there for me. And the time came that I did need them because my car got hit while it was parked out in front of my house in the middle of the night. I came out the next morning and the whole side of my car is all bashed in. Whoever hit my car had driven off. Now you would think that, you know, that should probably happen once in a person's life. I will tell you that has happened to me 4 times. I don't know what it is. 2 of those times it was in a church parking lot. Only 1 out of the 4 times did the person leave a note, and I will tell you it was a bogus note that led to nowhere. And that note was not left for me in the church parking lot. One of the times that happened in the church parking lot, I came out of the church service filled with the Holy Spirit to see my back bumper laying on the ground behind my car. And I'm thinking, okay, nobody takes off a back bumper without realizing that they just took off a back bumper. But there was no note. But I'm getting sidetracked here a little bit. My point was about my insurance company. When my car got hit out in front of my house, you know, I made the phone call. Hey, you know, this is what happened. I wasn't even driving the car. It was parked in front of my house. I came out the next morning. It's all bashed in. You know, I need you guys to be able to take care of it. Long story short, that was very disappointing. The whole experience, after years of paying these premiums, never having to make a claim, I finally make this claim, and they completely let me down. That's how I imagine, to a much greater degree, what this woman was feeling. Insurance, it's really not that big of a deal in the grand scheme of things, but when your daughter is demon-possessed, that's a big deal. When someone that you love is in a desperate situation, that's when you start caring a whole lot. And so this woman had heard that Jesus was in the neighborhood, and so she came crying out to him. You can see there in verse 22, "Behold, a woman of Canaan came from that region and cried out to him, saying, 'Have mercy on me, O Lord, son of David, my daughter is severely demon-possessed.'" Verse 23, "But he answered her not a word." I don't know if that messes with you at all. But the first thought that goes through my head is, that's not the Jesus that I know. Here is a woman who is in real need, because everything that she has tried in life has let her down. And now she's in a desperate situation, and now she has come to the very person who actually can help her, Jesus. But Jesus does not even open his mouth. See, this is what I'm talking about when the Lord messes with our understanding of how He works. Because I would imagine that there's been times in your life that you have really called out to God because you were in desperate need. This was your hour of desperation, and you turned to the Lord for help. But from your vantage point, He answered you not a word. I have known people that have walked away from Christianity because that was their experience. They felt like God must not care or He must not be there, because when I needed Him the most, He did not answer me a word. But I want you to understand something. God's silence does not mean that God is indifferent. When God stays quiet, it does not mean that He does not care. It does not mean that He is not there. It likely means He's got a bigger plan, a better work that He wants to do in your life or in the situation that you find yourself. But I know that if someone has a need for Jesus, we want Jesus to meet that need. We want to see the Lord work, and we want to see it to be powerful, and we want to see that person's heart turn to Christ because they saw how faithful He was, how loving He was, how ready He was to help them in their time of need. But when the Lord is silent, sometimes that is a very tough experience to go through, because we begin to think, what is going on? This isn't the Jesus that I know. So what in reality was Jesus doing? What was it that Jesus was doing by remaining silent? You know, it's difficult for us to really grasp the intensity of that moment, I think, because we do know the end of the story. I mean, we just read it. We know at the end of the story, the little girl is going to be healed. The demon is going to be cast out. She's going to be made whole. But in that very moment, that was not the case. So to try and understand why Jesus was being silent can be tough. You guys remember the movie The Karate Kid? The old one. I'm not talking about the newer one, but I mean the older one. And I say the older one because I never saw the newer one, so I don't know if it was the same. But there was in that movie a high school kid, Daniel-san, who was getting bullied and getting into fights with a group of guys that he went to school with. And so he wanted to learn to be able to defend himself. And he met a guy by the name of Mr. Miyagi. Mr. Miyagi, you know, had skills. You know, he knew karate. And so Daniel had asked Mr. Miyagi to teach him how to fight so that he could defend himself. So the first thing that Mr. Miyagi does, he says, show up tomorrow and we'll begin the training. And the next day, Daniel comes. And Mr. Miyagi takes him out to the yard and shows him about six cars and says, I want you to wax my cars. And he teaches him how to do it. Wax on, wax off. Daniel thinks, okay, I could do this. So he does the first car, thinking, okay, after the first car, maybe I'll get my karate lesson. But no karate lesson. More wax on and wax off. And when he finishes all the cars, he thinks he's ready for his lesson. And Mr. Miyagi says, no, you see that fence? I'm going to have you paint that fence. You put the paint on this way, and you brush the strokes down this way. And you use both hands. You don't just use one. You use both hands. And so he has to paint the whole fence. Now, the whole time that this is going on, Daniel's thinking, this is ridiculous. This has nothing to do with what I came to you for. What are you having me do all of these things for you? Why don't you just teach me what it is that I need to know? And it wasn't until he had completed what Mr. Miyagi had told him to do that Mr. Miyagi made him realize that the wax on and the wax off were to teach him the moves that he needed to know, the muscle memory that his body needed to know in order to do the moves that he would be taught in karate. You see, it's not until the end of the story that you really realize the purpose of why Mr. Miyagi did what he did. And it's the same with Jesus in this story. We don't really find what Jesus is doing until we get to the end of the story. Here's the thing, is in our lives, we're not at the end of the story. Many of you are right in the middle of the story, and you're at the part of the story where you feel like God's being silent. You keep holding on. You keep holding on. You will see how the Lord causes the story to unfold. And I guarantee you, by the end of your story, you will see how faithful that God is to reveal to you His goodness and His love. He has a purpose. He has a plan. But what's going to happen here in this story is that the Lord is going to reveal this woman's faith. Essentially, what He is going to do is He's going to set up several roadblocks. And this woman, by her faith in believing that Jesus could help her, busts through those roadblocks to get the help that she needs from the Lord. And I want you to see the progression of these roadblocks that Jesus puts up. The first one was His silence. As Jesus remained silent and didn't answer her as she called out to Him, she didn't go away thinking, well, I guess He doesn't want to help me. She persisted, it says. She kept after Him. She did not go away. So in verse 24, Jesus responds this way, speaking to His disciples who were there. But He answered and said, I was not sent except to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. So immediately in those words, which He was speaking to His disciples, but no doubt this woman heard those words, as He was indicating that I'm here for the Jews. I'm not here for the Gentiles. I do want you to know that there was an element of truth in what Jesus is communicating here, in that He came first for the Jews. Paul, in Romans chapter 1, he tells us, I am not ashamed of the gospel, for it is the power of God unto salvation for all those who believe, for the Jew first, and then for the Gentile. The gospel was going to be brought to the Jewish nation first. But that does not mean that God was not going to open up salvation or work among the Jews as well. In fact, earlier in Matthew's gospel, He had already healed the servant of the centurion, who himself was a Roman. He was a Gentile. And in John chapter 10, Jesus tells His disciples, as He's explaining to them that He is the good shepherd and that they are His sheep, Jesus said, I have other sheep, which was an indication of the Gentiles who also would be saved and become part of the flock of God. So Jesus was not just flat out saying, I'm here for Jews only, I don't care about the Gentiles. But in this moment, He was setting up another one of those roadblocks, indicating that it was the Jew first that He was coming to. Now, does the woman go away? No, she does not. Not only does she continue to follow after, but in verse 25, it says, then she came and worshiped Him, saying, Lord, help me. That word worshiped is the Greek word proskuneo, which means to prostrate oneself. Literally meant that the person would get on their face to the ground as an act of worship, as she is pleading with Jesus that Jesus would help her. So the second roadblock she blew through with worship. So a third roadblock is set up in verse 26. But He answered and said, it is not good to take the children's bread and throw it to the little dogs. Now I want to explain a few things about why Jesus is saying what He is saying. Going back to the Jewish attitude towards Gentile women, such as this woman here. Gentiles were often referred to as Gentile dogs or just dogs. That was a derogatory term that the Jews would use as a put down, as a means of rejection towards Gentile culture and the Gentiles that lived around them. So this woman was aware of how the word dog was used against her. But when the Jews referred to the Gentiles as dogs, they used a particular term that meant dog, but a specific type of a dog, a mangy, vicious scavenger dog. It would be one of those dogs that ran in the streets, picking at scraps, just trying to survive. A dog that nobody cared about. But that's not the word that Jesus used. See, Jesus used a word that made reference to a dog, but not the same type of dog that the Jewish religious leaders would use to speak of those Gentiles. Instead, Jesus used a term for a dog that essentially meant a pet dog, a dog that you would have at home, a dog that you care for, a dog that you feed, a dog that you have in your lap, a dog that you pet. The term that Jesus used was completely different. And I think that Jesus purposefully used this illustration to begin to open up the door for this woman's faith to come flooding in. Now, Jesus has set up these roadblocks, but this third roadblock, Jesus is indicating the kind of tender care that he really does have for this woman and the culture that she came from. And it's probably why she responded in this way, verse 27. And she said, "Yes, Lord, yet even the little dogs eat the crumbs which fall from the master's table." Jesus, the crumbs from your table are better than the cakes from the religion I came from the culture I came from the lifestyle I've been living. I would rather have the crumbs falling from your table than to have all the cake that the world has offered me. And suddenly we see this woman and her faith being purified, being elevated, being acknowledged by Jesus. In a sense, I see Jesus has like taken a diamond in the rough, and by each of these roadblocks that he has placed in her way, it has been like another cut in that diamond. And each cut is going to enable the light of Christ to shine through her even brighter. And each time he has set up a roadblock, she blows through that roadblock to pursue him even more. She requests, she worships, and she acknowledges that his crumbs are better than the cakes of the world. And so Jesus responds to her at that moment in verse 28. Then Jesus answered and said to her, "O woman, great is your faith. Let it be to you as you desire." And her daughter was healed from that very hour. See, Jesus did what I believe he intended to do from the very beginning. Jesus fully intended that this little girl would be set free from her demonic possession. But in the process, what he wanted to do is draw out this woman's faith, expand her faith, encourage her faith, cause her faith to even be a witness to all those that were around, including Jesus' disciples. And I think it's a lesson for us in the persistence that God wants us to have in seeking after him with all of our heart, soul, mind, and strength. I don't think it's an accident that when Jesus taught us to pray, he taught us to keep on asking, keep on seeking, keep on knocking. He put it in a continuous sense because he wanted it to be a continuous action in our life, that we would keep seeking him, keep pursuing him, keep requesting his help. And he will be faithful to give us the help when we have that time of need. It reminds me of when Jacob, in the book of Genesis, was wrestling with the Lord, wrestling with the angel of God. I think it's in Genesis 32, where this wrestling match is going on, and Jacob's hip is knocked out of joint. So he reaches out for the Lord, grabs a hold of him, and says, "I will not let go of you until you bless me." And he clung on to the Lord until he received that blessing from God. I see this woman doing exactly the same thing. "Jesus, I know that you are the answer. I know you are the only one that can help me. I will not let go of you until you bless me. Not really sure why you're being silent to me right now, but I'm not going to let go of you until you bless me. I'm not really sure why you're saying that you have only come for the Jews. I'm not going to let go of you until you bless me." And she gets her blessing. And Jesus rejoices in the greatness of her faith. Now you guys, many of you, might be somewhere in the process of these roadblocks. Maybe you have felt like God's been putting up roadblocks in your life. Not experiencing answers from your prayers. Not feeling like you're hearing His voice. You be persistent. You keep pursuing after Him. Because a day will come when you persist that He will say, "Great is your faith. As you have requested, it will be done unto you." There is one thing, though, I want you to take notice of before we wrap things up. And that is something I actually skipped over. I did so on purpose because I wanted to hold it to the end. But when Jesus answered her not a word in verse 23, I want you to see the response that the disciples had. "And Jesus answered her not a word. And his disciples came and urged him, saying, 'Send her away, for she cries out after us.'" In a sense, what I see here is the disciples are just annoyed that this woman is still following after them. That her need for them in that moment was just an annoyance. They were irritated, and this wasn't even the first time that they had suggested to Jesus that he send people away. In fact, just one chapter earlier, in chapter 14, as the multitudes were around them and the day had been far spent, the disciples come to Jesus telling them, "You know what? It's been a long day. These guys are probably hungry. Why don't you, Jesus, send them away so that they can go get something to eat for themselves?" Jesus isn't into sending people away. So Jesus told them at that time, "Why don't you give them something to eat?" And now here again, only one chapter later, we're again hearing those words from the disciples, "Send her away because she keeps crying out after us." I wonder if ever in your life that you get annoyed at the needs of people. People around you have needs, and maybe they're even hoping that you can help them with their situation, whatever problem they're going through. And something inside is saying, "Send them away. Send them away." Not only did they say, "Send them away," but it says, "For she cries out after us." That's really not what she did. She wasn't crying out after them. She was crying out after Jesus. I don't hear her once mentioning the disciples. It was Jesus that she was after. And here's the thing. I think sometimes when people cry out to us, because they've got issues going on in their life, we hear it as a cry for our help. But whether they realize it or not, the internal cry is that they're crying out for the only help that they could get, and that is the help that Jesus offers. The thing is that we are His ambassadors. We are His hands, we are His feet. And it would be so important that we would not have the hard attitude of sending people away, but of realizing that the cry of people's hearts is for Jesus. Now, whether they can articulate it in that way, whether they really know it's Jesus or not, we know that what they need is Jesus. So I would encourage you that the next time someone may be crying out to you, don't get annoyed and want them to go away. Maybe the Lord has created that very point in time that you would be an extension of His hands and His feet and His voice. One final thing. I don't know if God has always been what you expected Him to be. There may be times in your life when you have felt let down by Him. And you might be experiencing one of those times right now. I want to encourage you, you hold on. You keep crying out after Him. You prostrate yourself before Him. Because He is a faithful God. He will never do anything outside of His nature. But there are times that He will do things outside of our perception of Him. And what He is allowing to happen is our perception of Him to grow. Because God is bigger than you've ever thought before. His love is deeper than you can even imagine. And sometimes the box that we have placed Him in has limited Him too much. And He wants to blow the doors off of that. Part of blowing the doors off of your perception of Him is sometimes taking you through the valley of the shadow of death. A struggle. But in the end, you will see how faithful He is to you and your need. Because that's the kind of God that He is.